Mine.
No.
Yes.
Not so much.
Kind of, in a way, sort of, almost. I didn't think anybody else could be here.
Right.
This left hand, the right hand, and in case one spins.
This is going to be way
more. This is Rocky Rose in Mosel Valley, which I've been living in Naples, wine drink since the days of the Roman Empire. They know what they're doing. This is a backup in case this one.
So?
I won't. Good, that would be alcohol.
Is this on?
No.
I had a radio call. Somebody said, what is the contingency plan for power failures? What don't I know? What's going on?
Thunderstorm.
Yeah, I know. That's. Have you noticed? Yes, I know what's going on. So it's not like there has been one. They're asking if there is one. Okay. The
contingency plan in the event of a power failure is...
I'm going to shout very loudly!
Okay!
Let me get a top hat. Ladies and gentlemen! See, normally, they say that you're supposed to leave some head space in the wine. I have a chemist, that's bullshit. It doesn't happen.
There won't be any space left in my head if I drink that much.
I love this movie. Have I mentioned that?
Yeah. In the title for that, I call him a Roberts.
I always thought it was where. I mean, you have a wine glass and you've got all this wasted space at the top here, and there was no point. It's because some snotty guy could say, I detected overtones of a leather rotar not the skunk. Then he does this sort of thing. Yes, I believe I shall have a glass. I'm sorry, what are we doing here? That's great.
Actually, before we start,
yes.
If it's okay with you, answering all the burning questions that you might have, for science is a very special announcement.
We do.
Yeah.
Dr. Kathy Gervasi.
I haven't drunk that much yet.
The founder of First Science, the pioneering researcher in this field, and the person who can best be described as the conscience of First Science in everything we do, from how we conduct research to how we interact with all of you at every convention we attend, even when Kathy is not here with us. To mark the occasion of her official retirement.
Cool.
Not from science, from professorial duties.
Yes.
At Niagara County Community College, on behalf of the First Science team, I am thrilled to elevate Dr. Kathy Gervasi to First Science's very first and greatly deserved rank of her science professor emerita.
Oh, that's so exciting.
With all the rates of privileges that
rank.
You
get the drink.
Yeah, guys.
Oh,
look at that.
And to show off her new status and new rank in the style of all things furry, being larger than life, and always way more fun, I'm presenting our new professor emerita. Professor Emerita with this giant, ridiculously oversized credential, ID tag.
To be clear, I am not retiring from from First Science, one of the reasons I wanted to retire was to spend more time on First Science. So pretty excited about that. Thank you.
So what's this about?
Okay.
We have to ask you questions.
Right, yeah. So we thought what we could maybe do is we could direct questions along the path. We'll start from Dr. G to Dr. Conway, to Dr. Roberts, Dr.
Thank you, Doctor.
And
I think of the three stooges.
Yep.
So we thought
we'd
maybe...
Can I be Larry?
Yes. I have to be
Curly. Yep.
Chelsea's amazing. This is my, awesome RA. Thank you, Chelsea.
Oh, we're getting some flood warnings. Everyone's last flood warning. Evacuate now.
Another
one. Everybody
no.
Get on a higher
flash flood warning. Okay. If water starts coming in through the floor here, we've got a lot more things to worry about. Okay?
End of days.
So I think that the idea was here. Thank you all for being here. Really appreciate it. If you want, we thought we could maybe do this an audience directed talk.
Sure.
Turn your phone.
An audience directed talk. You try and keep your questions to about 60 seconds, but we'll start with. I didn't say the answers, I said the question. Yeah. Who has a question for Dr. G? And if we, yeah, we'll pick as we go. So she gets to pick her question.
It's kind of a two-parter. One, what is First Science and how did it start?
Okay, First Science is a collaboration amongst a number of different social behavioral scientists, Dr. Roberts, myself, Dr. Plante, who unfortunately can't be here because he finally got a real job in Quebec and had...
It's so true, though.
It's true. It's totally
he had to move from Edmonton to Quebec, which is a very long trip, and he doesn't drive, so it makes it a little more challenging.
And he did it in a U-Haul.
Yeah.
On his behalf, I'll say, sorry, buddy.
And Dr. Stephen Ryson, who's in Texas, and Dr. Elizabeth Fine, who's actually here in Duquesne. And our goal is to... understand what the furry fandom is all about, the importance of fursonas. If you can think of it and it has to do with furries, we're interested in it. And we've also begun looking at other fandoms. This is my opinion. Not so much because the fandoms are interesting per se, but because they are interesting comparison points to what happens in the furry fandom. For example, think about the difference between a fursona and a fursuit versus what someone in anime might be doing when they're cosplaying. So they're different kinds of role things, but we think they may operate differently. So what was the rest of the question? How did it start?
Yes.
Oh, gosh.
Started with Kathy.
A long time ago, in the early 2000s, I had a tiny little part-time job where I was moderating an academic chat group for anthrozoologists, and someone asked one day, does anybody know anything about furries? And I would let someone else answer the question, but no one answered that question. And then I realized nobody knew anything about furries except some really rotten, you know George Gurley types. So I read the dreaded Vanity Fair article and I was pretty stunned, and I thought, if it's true, someone should, be doing research on that. And if it's not true, that's even worse. Someone should be doing research on that to say, you know what you're talking about. So that was really the origin. And then as we went along, we got Dr. Plante, who was a grad student at the time, and he was TAing for Dr. Roberts, and we all got connected.
Excellent. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Who has a question for Dr. Conway?
Be nice now. Gentlemen.
Do you think anonymity plays a role in the furry opening up to each other?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In the very, very early days of furry fandom, let's face it, every single one of us thought we were alone. And maybe even today, everybody thinks, I'm the only one. If you didn't go to a science fiction convention and hold up a giant sign that says, I like cartoon animals, because it was, that's kid stuff, or whatever people would do, they would sneer at you. The ability to broach the subject anonymously, particularly with someone that you already knew was a friendly audience, I think was vital to people actually being able to express themselves to one another. So that's the answer. Cheers.
Okay, who has a question for me? I saw your hand pop up first.
So this might be kind of a question for the entire panel, but just out of curiosity, I know that you've published a lot of papers of late, and I remember that one of Dr. Degrassi's and Dr. Conway's papers that actually was super rebuttal.
Yeah, screw him.
So I haven't seen any, and the way the peer publishing goes is if you publish a paper and then someone wants to criticize it, they go through the editor, and I would think most editors are going to, and that's what happened with ours, most editors will say something like, I'm about to publish this paper, do you have anything to say about that? And we weren't actually allowed to say what we wanted to say. We wrote a great rebuttal and totally tore them apart. And the editor said, could you be less? Less what? Less critical or point out fewer of the flaws? And he kind of said both. And I'm like, so that's why Nuka came up with the title of that article, which is Why So Furious. So I'm not aware of any other.
No, I mean, I think that, I mean, that was a, it was the first peer review publication of its time ever. And, you know, I think it was the starting ground. I mean, I found personally myself trying to get started in publishing on the furry fandom was very difficult. I'm not an ounce of exaggeration. I received on my first submission, I received the rejection letter that said, Dear Dr. Roberts, wasting our time is really unprofessional. End of rejection letter. And for me, I'm a pretty tenacious person, so all I did was I took that rejection letter and quoted it into the review for the next one and said, this is what I'm up against. These, you know, this deserves to be heard. The science is good. Please just read it. I'm not punking you studying furries. And I actually got a really lovely letter from that editor for Health and Social Work that said, yeah, this is a really important topic, and yeah, nobody's really doing anything about it. I was trying to get into the clinical literature at that point to basically say, furries aren't crazy people. There's all kinds of functionality for this fandom, and here's how you can understand it better if you find somebody with an anthropomorphic identity in clinical practice.
We aimed very high. We're like, why don't we just put a letter in the New England Journal of Medicine?
Yeah, my I do.
We're not. I don't know if you know, like, there's a pecking order of academic publications, so we ended up in a social work journal, but, you know, it could have been worse, I guess.
Social work's fine. Thank you.
Before we go on, there was the gentleman mentioned an actual rebuttal.
Yes.
I do remember that you sent that to me, and I read the first three sentences on the John and threw it aside. Could you just give us a very quick synopsis of well, that's how I usually handle rebuttals. A quick synopsis of what their actual thesis was, or yeah. Rather their antithesis.
They claimed that our sample might have been flawed, and did we realize that we were collecting data at a convention? Yeah, we did. And that maybe, so they wanted it both ways. They wanted to say our sample was flawed, and they were at the same time kind of making fun of furries, saying that, well, these people were probably, I don't know, carousing on drugs, blah, 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 so how can you believe anything they told you? They, that was kind of what they wanted to do. And,
which reflects a shameful prejudice on the role of that reviewer.
Yeah, and this was an academician from Australia. We just call her Fiona now. We'll go, oh, member Fiona? Yeah, okay, don't say Fiona. And this, to me, the sad thing was the editor of Society and Animals was the guy that encouraged me. I said, I'm working on this project. There was no peer-reviewed publication about furries. Do you want it? Yes, please, yes, please, yes, please. Because they gave his journal some status or something. And then he turns around and lets this lady write this piece of crap.
Well, it's also interesting because at this point, we're the ones that are offering critiques of other people's writing.
Yeah.
So tables have turned.
So I guess the question now for
Dr. G. Dr. G, question. You get to
yes.
So there's obviously thousands of us here that is great. What is DC and, say, rising
Oh, we get a lot of, we're regularly approached by people right here at Anthrocon. You know, I'm doing my XYZ thesis, I'm about to go to grad school, can I work with you? That kind of thing. So there's a fair amount of interest in that. We just got a, was it an undergraduate thesis on therianthropy? People send us things like, oh, I want to know what I'm working on, or can you give me some information? So on our First Science website, we have tons of information, including a book of about 160 pages, five years worth of results. So we get a fair amount of that. The issue, a challenge, is as academics, we like to recruit other professors to work with us, and it's very easy to identify people that we would love to have, but those are usually senior faculty that already have a committed program of research, and they're like, well, that's really interesting, but I'm busy. So that's kind of how we got Dr. Fine, because she was A, here in Pittsburgh, her research was relevant, and she was brand new, so she was happy to collaborate. So there are challenges about that. Somebody today just told me they wrote a college paper, and they used our work because it was a sociology class, and they had a list of topics. You're not going to be happy. They had a list of, like, perversion topics that the students could choose from, and one of them was furry. And so this student kind of wrote a rebuttal to that, and then I told the student how we sent Nuka a couple years ago. So there was a weird sex conference in New York City.
It was all on BDSM and kink. Yeah.
And they had a call for papers. And
including furries.
Yeah, and in their call for papers was like, well, come tell us about weird furry sex or something like that. So we said, Nuka, you need to do a submission and tell them it's not what they think.
Yeah, and he wrote, the title of the paper was Why I Should Not Do a Presentation on Furries at your Conference.
And it was accepted.
Yes, it was. So then we had to send him to New York.
Yeah, where he didn't want to be. Yeah.
And he did a presentation. He actually got the last spot. And to all the people who were doing kink and fetish work, explain why this was inappropriate to include furries in this call for papers. Which
it's good to have a junior faculty member who needs to beef up their CVs. You can say, oh, this is a good opportunity for you.
Works pretty well. If I could just pick up one quick thing on the students. I mean, we have a lot of people who, like, you know, thank you, like what we do. We appreciate that. I think... The bigger challenge is when people say, we want to be involved in the project, how do we get involved? It's much easier for us if people come with, like, a fully conceived idea, and then we can help manage that. Like, we, you know, that's when our resources can be useful to other people. You know, for us to design a project is a bit difficult, but for people who have, you know, I'm going to be a master's student, I've got an idea for a thesis, and here's how I'd like to execute it. Okay, let's see how our resources can help facilitate that education. Absolutely, those are the kinds of things that are much easier for us to handle.
The other really useful thing is if you have an idea or a question or a hypothesis, oh, you guys haven't studied X yet, those are often very, very helpful and insightful.
Okay, question for Dr. Conway.
Gentlemen, here he is. Yes, you.
Okay. So Anthrocon's been around for a really long time.
Yeah.
exploded in the furry fandom. So, I've heard you talk about your origin story and how you found fandom, but when you were approached to become the chairman of what for a long time was the world's biggest furry tradition, I'm curious as to what made you want to stay in the fandom, what the challenges are as you become the chairman, and what sort of, I guess, progression you see.
I've often playfully embellished the tale of how I became chairman of Anthrocon, but I'll now give you the straight answer. I was Anthrocon's guest of honor in 1998, and for whatever reason, I guess so that the guests would be aware of what the staff was up to, they had a staff mailing list, and they included me on it. And I kept telling myself I was just going to stay quiet, but I had been working conventions since a long time before that. I was pretty well experienced in the field in various departments. And I got to the point where I just couldn't stay quiet anymore, and I started saying, okay, guys, that's a really cute idea, but, you know, Balticon tried that in 1987, and, you know, the sky fell down, and you know, reindeer developed clown noses or something like that, and I don't think you really want to do that. And they said, well, what should we do? I said, well, you should probably do, you know, this and that. And then more and more, they were saying, okay, how should we run this event? And it just kind of morphed into, eventually they just said, why don't you just take over? I said, okay, sure, why not? I didn't take it over as the world's largest furry convention. I took it over as the second American furry con, an East Coast furry convention. The goal at that point was just to put on a convention. Not even to survive, it was just to put on a good show and be able to do it the next year. I guess they did survive. What kept me at it? The fact that I figured we had to be doing something, right? Because it just kept growing every single year. And it got bigger and bigger, and the feedback was great. And very early on, we were battling the stigma which came from the early days of furry fandom, when the idea of public decorum at conventions was a novelty. I don't like people digging with me, all right? And the fact that these people were sneering at my crowd ticked me off. So I rather vigorously defended it, not just because it's my thing, but because these are magnificent people and very well worth defending, and I'm not about to see some asshole out there tear them down. That's the Philadelphia. The stigma early on, we've all known that furries are all about sex and everything, furries are all about sex. I have taken a perverse delight in shutting down people who say that. And I've gotten a good repertoire. One year, as a matter of fact, our first year in Pittsburgh, somehow the folks at WDVE got hold of my private cell phone number. And it was at the guest of honor dinner, my phone rang, and I picked it up, and they said, "Hi, you're live on WDVE. We got Dr. Samuel Conway down at Anthrocon. How would you like to answer some questions?" I said, "All right, if I must." I was sort of in the middle of dinner. And they just kept firing at me, "So, tell us about the hot sex that's going on down there." And I said, "Okay, well, first off, that's not the entire point of our convention. That's what we are here for." And they wouldn't let it go. They were just, "Oh, no, come on, give it to us, come on, tell us, you know, you guys are getting, you're having, like, hot reindeer sex in those costumes, aren't you, with the clown noses and everything, come on, it's all about sex, this is all good." And finally I lost my temper and said, all right, I admit it, furries are the only people on the face of the planet who have sex and you're just jealous. There's about 5 seconds of dead air, and then, "Well, thank you very much. This has been Dr. Samuel Conway down at Anthrocon." Did that answer your question? I got a little lost there. Thank you.
Question for Dr. Roberts. Go ahead. Thank you.
What were some of the questions that arose as a result from your findings during the research? Like, some of the things that have gone on in the
Everything. I have a whole life of work to do on this. There's everything. I mean, research is an evolving process, right? So you end up asking a question, and then you get some answers, and you think, well, now I have more questions. And sometimes especially when you're digging into new territory, like starting a new field of work, you know, you're not even sure if the questions you asked are necessarily the right ones. So we'll ask them, and then we'll re-ask them, and we'll re-ask them again. And it's a slow, evolving process. So, for example, our project on therianthropy, you know, we really wanted to make sure we get it right. And it's important to us to make sure we get it right. So part of the process is simply even, you know, how do we define things first? And then that can take 2-3 years of focus groups to do this. Now, one of the things that I'm trying to do to try and facilitate this and make this, you know, to make it a little faster, we came up with something called the For Science Universal Recruitment Project. And this is a database study 2 on firstscience.com/participate. So if you're interested in participating. What we're interested in doing is creating a database. I think after, you know, all the work that Dr. G has done, after all the years, I think we're 14 years into this now, I think the fandom knows that we're pretty trustworthy. At least I really hope that's how people see this. And that we're looking to do scientific exploration. And sometimes that means that we need to, like, dig in and find specific people to answer specific questions. So if we try and study therianthropy, and we're, you know, waving around a clipboard going, hey, therians, anybody who's a therian, can you come? You know, it's not always productive. I think we had a survey once that didn't work out that well.
We did more than one.
But I can tell you about our biggest failure.
Oh, no.
This is it. This is your answer right here, I think.
This is epic. And it wasn't furries. It was furry related. So a couple years ago, I had an honors social psych class. I was just trying to give them sort of a thought exercise of, you know, what could we do? And we really don't know a lot about what the average person on the street thinks about furries. And I thought, you know,
this one.
I thought, well, oh, wait, brainstorm. We could go to Anthrocon a day early, which would be the 4th of July. This was a couple. Last year, and I know 50,000 people will be standing around waiting for the fireworks, just like, you know, thousands of furries are working their way through the registration line. So clearly, we could get, you know, at least a couple thousand people on the street to fill out a very, very simple little survey about what they know about furries and what they think about furries. Yeah. Okay. So we printed what, 4,000?
4,000 pamphlets.
Yeah. And it was so hot. Really, really hot. And the nice police officers at the point wouldn't let us in, even though I had tried for days to get permission, because that's where all the people were. So we deployed all over along the river and where all the people watching fireworks would be.
I just looked up the number on it, Kathy. People who even clicked on it, not who answered. Go for it.
Yeah, what, 100?
27.
27!
That's where I started. I apologize.
And then was the thunder and lightning.
And floods.
I'm like, I give up. This, wow. I've never had such a bad. It was horrible.
It was a total disaster.
Yeah, because so we just assumed anybody standing in a line doing nothing would be happy to fill out a survey.
If I can answer, just do a quick little story. So, you know, we all do research. We do furry research, but we all have other areas that we work on as well. I'm an identity researcher, and I study transition to adulthood, and I study academic success in university students, too. And so one of the things that I got called in to do on a project this year had to do with preparedness for university at York University, Toronto University of Toronto, Western University, and the University of Waterloo. So they wanted me to do this, be the Waterloo lead. And now I'm used to furries answering our work who are like super engaged and really interested. We get what regularly 50 to 65% response
rate.
Yeah,
right now we've given out almost all of our 2,500 surveys, and we're over 1,200 back.
I mean, incredible. Like,
it's, like, awesome.
Yeah, in research, if you get 20, you're ecstatic, right? So we did these, we sent, you know, in my department at Waterloo, I think we sent just under 6,000 students an invitation to do this, and then sent them reminders a few times over. We had 2-5% response rate across all the universities. And I've been, and you know what, my colleagues were thrilled. And I'm thinking, I'm just spoiled working with this community who's like super interested. And if I can just do like one quick story, I just want to tell you about my colleague named Zach, who came in from McGill. He's our gender expert that we brought in, and he came to a furry convention at Camp Burns. And you know, I mean, as academics, we're used to what, 6 people showing up for a conference. When we do a conference talk, it's very bad, you know, and most of them are asleep or fiddling on their phones or whatever it is they're doing. No one cares. And we were at Camp Burns, and we had the ballroom. We filled the ballroom for a research talk. And he came back, and he said, like, I don't even understand this. I don't even, what was even funnier was that he had gone to a panel where he had taken off his jacket, and I don't think people realized he was on the research team, and someone said, oh, I went to the First Science panel, and for the next 15 minutes, relayed every slide that we had talked about in the presentation. And he was, I've never seen anything like this community in my life. And I'm like, yes. Exactly. Oh, hi. All right. Question for Dr. Conway.
The gentleman here.
What's the strangest or most interesting facts that you have discovered?
Wow. Remember who you're talking to. The strangest facts. Okay. I'll defer to the project leaders on this. The strangest, okay. Maybe not strangest, but what would we say are the most surprising, the most unexpected findings?
Well, I guess I'll twist it around a little bit, but the thing that always intrigues me that we still don't have an answer for, at least not one that I think is very satisfactory, is why is there such a disproportionate number of guys versus females in the fandom? I know what Sharon used to think, but I don't think she thinks it anymore.
What was that?
Well, remember when I said, why do you think there's so many more guys than girls? And you said, oh, you don't remember?
I have no idea. This is close to me. Yeah.
She said, it's the porn.
Oh, yeah, I can see that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You can see me say it. Oh, yeah.
All right. I'm going to...
We're done now?
I'm going to hijack the question and ask this. What have your findings indicated? What is the current approximate proportion of homosexual males that you would find in the fandom, bisexual?
Well, we find that the community is just over 70% LGBTQ.
Yes. And the question has been one that's been on my mind since the very beginning. It's undeniable that there is a very significant proportion of, shall we say, alternative sexuality individuals in the fandom.
And gender identity, yeah.
Yeah. Now, I've always wondered, is that because people who are, shall we say, gender adventuresome attracted furry fandom, or does furry fandom attract people like that? And I was having a discussion with Dr. Roberts, since I think it was you, I don't remember. I was a little low. Remember that breakfast? If we look at the very early days of furry fandom was just beginning in the 1980s. At a time when to be a homosexual or to be a person of alternative sexuality or gender neutrality or fluidity at the time was to be doomed to a life of bitter, bottomless loneliness because you didn't have any way to meet with people like yourself. If you were a gay man in the 80s, what could you do? You could go down to a club where you had an equal chance of being beat up or being arrested or of catching a fatal disease, as you did of actually meeting someone worthwhile. It was not an easy time for people of alternative sexuality. But then furry fandom came along, which was rooted in the internet and rooted in anonymity. And for the first time, people had a safe place. Even virtual, they had a place they could go in safety, where they could meet others, where they didn't have to be lonely, where they could talk to people who understood. You know, is there a large percentage of people of alternative sexuality in the fandom? Yes, because for a long time, fandom was the haven. And the flood warnings. So, yeah.
I got thrown off by the flood warning.
You did.
Yeah, you know, I think here's, you know, there are a series of things that are just simply transformative moments for me that have happened in the fandom, and actually one of them was in the 2017 AnthroCon. So in 2017 AnthroCon, I was recruiting into the FERP study 2 on First Science / Participate, and I was going through the registration line, and I came across two women. I guess for the purposes of the story, trans women is important. I would just see them as women. And I said, hey, you know, I'm recruiting, I'm Dr. Roberts, blah, 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 for science, funded, blah, 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 University of Canada, that kind of stuff. And, you know, we're recruiting into this database, you know, if you'd like to leave your email, we'll contact you and let you know, how you can participate and give you an informed consent. You can make an informed choice then. And what I found were people who said, well, I'm not furry, but I just know that I can be myself here and no one's going to be an ass. And that was so striking to me that this became a place that had a reputation of just accepting people for who they were, that the kinds of ostracism and discrimination and hardships that are, you know, that flourish in everyday life seem to be a safe haven. We're no longer there, and the fandom became a safe haven for all people, regardless if they were furry or not. And that was so striking to me, and it said everything to me about what this community means to its participants, but to people outside it as well.
Okay, you're up.
Oh, well, I just spoke, so who's next?
Well, actually, wait a minute. To answer the person's question, because I don't think we actually did, I recall one particular bit of conclusion that was drawn in the early days of the study, when you had a measure of neurosis, of neurotic.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and you chose the, because our age group at the time was people in the college age, you went to a standard college, you know, here are college age people who are furries and college age people who are not furries. What is the measure of neurotic description? And apparently it was discovered that furries are a lot less neurotic than your average college student.
It was our very first study, and Dr. Conway had warned us that no one would want to participate, which was, you know, a reasonable warning, but turned out not to be true. But anyway,
I'm still shy in those days.
Okay. You just never know until you try. So anyway, we were very concerned that if we asked people about themselves in certain regards that they might be kind of reluctant to answer. So we asked about, you know, how would you describe the typical furry, and kind of had a checklist of characteristics, et cetera, et cetera. And so then by comparison, we asked college students, how would you describe the typical college student? And it was very, very interesting to me that the typical college student, as described by other college students, was rated as significantly more neurotic than the furry sample saw the typical furry. So the following year, we asked people to describe themselves, and there wasn't much of a difference, if I remember correctly.
My favorite questions are the one where we ask about persona and then fursona, and to account for order effects, we mix it up and we have different versions of our survey available. But I think the one that was most striking to me was actually something that one of my graduate student or my undergraduate student did for her honors thesis, and looked at anxiety between fursona and persona. We asked, think of your fursona, imagine yourself in your fursona in the last 4 weeks, answer the following questions, and gave an anxiety measure. And we found overwhelmingly that compared to the persona, the fursona had far less anxiety. And to me, that was fascinating. I'm most interested in the fursona piece to figure out, you know, how that serves as a buffer, it serves as this like functional identity formation piece to, you know, an exploration piece to figure out who people are.
I just spoke, but I
haven't seen anybody from this side, so go for it.
I have a question for you. I think all of you.
You can direct it, it's okay.
I've always described just like the basic way to start furry is the media and the descriptions on furry. Like there's always been, I know there's always been different definitions of furry is.
Well, can I tell you what came out of Lisa Ling's mouth that was actually really out of my mouth?
No.
Quotation. I describe a furry as someone who has an interest in anthropomorphic artwork, someone who gives human characteristics to animals. And, you know, like someone would cosplay as their favorite character, people create fursonas, and, you know, but these are usually imbued with positive attributes of the self, idealized versions of self. And that over time, these have benefits that translate into everyday life. That would be my definition. And it was really surreal, though. I gotta say, when Lisa Ling was, you know, when that show came out, and I heard the words on the over voiceover. I was like, those are my words. Those are my words, she said. But you know what? To her credit, I was glad they got it right. So that's how I would see it.
We asked a question, I want to say it was maybe about 3 years back, and we were trying to, you know, address this issue of how do you define furry. So we asked people a series of questions. They were open-ended, which is always kind of a research nightmare, but, you know, if someone asks you, you know, what does it mean to be a furry, or what does it mean to be a Therian, or to be an other kin? How would you explain to them what that means? And then I use like a word analysis to kind of compare the kinds of descriptions that people gave for those different identities. And they were meaningfully different. I think it's in Furries Among Us 2, there's that chapter. If I remember correctly, words about furries were things like fun and art, and, you know, kinds of things that I guess you would probably expect. And Therian was more about, you know, internal and spirit, and not necessarily limited to that, of course. So we've always felt that it would be inappropriate for us to put a definition on it. Scientifically speaking, that's a disadvantage because we always like to have an operational definition, which is right now, if you say you're a furry, you're a furry.
So just to clarify, I have a media definition that I use, and I'm trying to explain it to the public, and then we have a research definition, which is a bit more challenging, but basically we go on people's words. If you think you're a furry, then that's good enough for us.
Yeah.
Anything to add, Dr. Conley?
Mine is primarily the media definition. A furry is somebody who's fascinated with the concept of anthropomorphic animals. then that pretty much is full stop at that point. That says just about everything. I am pressed on the matter, you know, what exactly is a furry? So a person's fascinated with anthropomorphic animals, what kind of person is a furry? The answer to that is slightly more esoteric, but it boils down to persons of boundless creativity. That is the hallmark of furries. They're not only people who are fascinated with anthropomorphic animals, they're people who are not afraid to dream.
Yes.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh. Let me write that down. That was great.
Persona is related to dissociative identity disorder. If we were to ask that question, it would all be based on self-report, and that's been somewhat of a challenging concept. And right now we're looking a lot at autism, and you know, we've got people that say they've been diagnosed by professional people that think they're autistic, but they've never been diagnosed. People that say they've been diagnosed, but they reject the diagnosis, that kind of thing. So we haven't really got into that too much. I know that looking at therianthropy, I have done an extensive review of the clinical literature. And what I see in the clinical literature, talking about stuff written by psychiatrists who tend not to be, are there any psychiatrists here, tend not to be great scientists from what I can tell, because they can't keep their definitions straight. I don't see any evidence, even with that, that from our perspective, it looks like a disorder.
Actually, Dr. G, I recall that in the very, very initial stages of the study, we have postulated the existence of species identity disorder. Has that hypothesis been disproven?
That hypothesis grew out of what was the DSM-TR-4, which was the standard at the time. And the origin of the hypothesis was the Gurley article that claimed there were these people running around that thought they were bears and worms and stuff. And the logical extrapolation of that was something like a species identity disorder. And at this point, there is not such a thing as gender identity disorder anymore. So we certainly wouldn't go there. However, all of that being said, there certainly are people, some may be furries, some may not be furries. We know a fair number of therians like to go to Anthrocon probably for the same reason that lots of other alternative people do, that really feel like, you know, they're in the wrong body. Yeah. So to whatever extent that parallels gender dysmorphia is kind of similar, I wouldn't call that a disorder. Just based on, you know, the samples of folks that we have.
I think for me, if you examine fantasy versus escapism, I think we find the distinction in your question. And that would be that fantasy is a natural and normal departure from, you know, everyday life. Not in a way that you lose sight of who you are, but just in like, I'm going to read, you know, a romance novel, or I'm going to watch a book, or I'm going to engage in this artwork, or I'm going to go online and engage as in my fursona. And overwhelmingly, what we see with furries is that's how they're engaging in the furry fandom. It's fantasy and not escapism. Like anything that you do too much, that would be probably the boundary that we would suggest. So if you are losing sight of who you are, or if you're engaged in, you know, you do video gaming for 23 hours a day, those are not things that are probably going to be productive to one's own self, you know, well-being. So those would be sort of limitations. But in my opinion, anyway, from what I have seen, it hasn't really been a dissociative sort of thing at all.
I apologize. I thought I heard a cork. Go ahead.
I stood for Dr. Brown.
Oh, yes. How about here in the front row? Don't get old, you won't like what happens. the question is two questions. Yes. Speaking of anxiety, what have the findings been on people with disabilities in the fandom? And a question directly to me is, other than the sign language interpreters we have, what do you do to make this convention inclusive? I'll answer my part first. The simple answer is, So the question is, other than the sign language interpreters, what does Anthrocon do for people with disabilities? The answer to that is anything we can. The entire purpose of us being here is that everyone is able to participate. If we find any barrier that is preventing somebody from having fun, we overcome it. And we are very, very dedicated to that. We understand that there are some disabilities that are not visible, and we try to remain cognizant of that. And again, if you come to Anthrocon, we want you to enjoy yourself. And if there's something that is preventing that, we will do our level best. We may not necessarily have a lot of tools at our disposal, but we will do our level best to attempt to overcome those barriers. So the other part of the question, people with disabilities in the fandom, has that arisen in your research?
Yes. Our recent focus groups, and we haven't even had a chance to talk about this yet, but we will today. We've been asking people what kinds of things could be provided for them at the convention that would give them a better time, have them be more comfortable. And just as Dr. Conway said, there are some kind of problems, concerns that people have that are not obvious. And we'll be working on sharing that information with you.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And so that, you know, we can address some of these things. So I, as a social psychologist, and Dr. Roberts, as a sociologist, kind of pretty much my whole life that I've been a social psychologists have felt that, you know, it's cool to collect information and data, stuff like that, just sort of like mental activity, keep your brain alive, but you should be using that in a meaningful way to try and make people's lives better, and that's one of the things that we're working on with our focus groups, and hopefully maybe by next year you'll see some of the products of that.
I'll share a tiny story. There was an anime convention that I attended in England a couple of years ago, and there was a young lady who was nonverbal. She would not speak, but the one thing she wanted to do was sing at the talent show, and I encouraged her to do so. And she got up, and I could tell she was very nervous, and she began, I never actually heard her voice, but she looked out over the audience and I saw her looking out over all the people, and she started to falter and she opened her mouth and nothing came out. I'm not a psychiatrist, I'm not a social scientist, but I like movies. There's a fantastic movie called The King's Speech, and a scene in there came to mind. So I got up from the audience and I sat down on the floor in front of her and I said, "Don't pay attention to them, sing for me." And she did, and she was angelic. She can speak now. Just wanted to add that. Like I said, we do what we can.
Like unlimited amount of data to search through, what would be your first kind of challenges or kind of issues to resolve?
Wow.
Okay.
Where to store it?
Can I just tell you more about what my dream is?
Yes, please.
I dream to have like an RV, the
she's
going
to be. I'm a fan of the RV now since I'm retired. I can drive it around with my dogs.
I hear you're a wild driver.
It does scare my husband.
So my vision. So I'm the money person on the team. I'm the one who gets all the funding. And I am, at so far, since 2012, we're at, I think, $365,000 of funding from the government and universities for what we do. I want someone to pay for the Furby. And this will be the most amazing RV that will hold research assistants and Dr. G and all her dogs, because those are important. And it has cameras in it. And it will allow for us to really capture what it's like to, A, do the research, but, B, to really capture what people's lives are. So it'll be all decked out with the cameras and all that good stuff. That's my dream.
The last time she gave us that dream, we told her she was crazy. But she could write any grant she wanted. So she wrote a different grant, and we got, what, $250,000?
Yeah, just over $250,000.
But they're Canadian dollars, so don't get the
$98.
There, go for it.
I have a question about non-homosexual furries. Have you reached any conclusions on the type of individual who is attracted to the furry community other than homosexual people who have loneliness issues?
I have an interesting story about that. One of our very first surveys, it may have been maybe 2006 or 2007, I can't remember for sure. We had a really simple question, you know, what's your sexual orientation? This, I had never seen words like pansexual before. But anyway, so someone on that survey wrote, I believe it was a male person, wrote, I'm heterosexual, but I wouldn't tell anyone to hear that. So they felt like they really were in a minority and they needed to keep it to themselves. So, kind of interesting. I don't really know. I mean, I from our research, I think a couple years ago we asked about, you know, what are the norms of the fandom, and it was very obvious that the expected norms of the fandom are to be open and accepting. Mm-hmm. So it really shouldn't matter what anyone's individual characteristics are. They should feel like they belong.
We have a paper coming out in Furries Among Us 3 that deals exactly with this thing, and I will send you an early copy.
Great. Thank you.
Let's start over with Dr. G.
Is that a question for Dr. G?
Red shirt?
Yeah.
So speaking of your output, I'm kind of wondering if you could discuss how your research is being consumed externally or other derivative research.
That's a great question. I guess the answer depends on who the audience is. So if you're a member of the furry fandom, I think you pretty much like our research because I think it has contributed to the destigmatization of the fandom. If you're an academic, you might be pretty much unaware of the research. If you're one of my adult children, two of whom are researchers, one's a sociologist and one's a psychologist, and my oldest kid's an attorney, they think I'm kind of crazy. But, Mom. However, what's interesting about that is they, you know, they have social lives and whatever, and when they hear people talking smack about furries, they tell them, you don't know what you're talking about. My mother is one of the, you know, world's researchers on furries, and here's the truth. And that's kind of cool. And then my oldest kid, that's so funny, she gets a copy of Furries Among Us, and she's like, could you autograph this for my friend?
When we're dealing with the media, we're all in business in the front, right? And I can pull out all of the syllabic terminology and all the crap that I have to. But when we're dealing with the community itself, you know, we're really tongue-in-cheek, and we're not shy to sort of, you know, make ourselves look a little silly. And there are a couple reasons for that. I mean, we know that we're not better than the furry community, and we get you. And so we're happy to, you know, sort of exist as these, if you will permit us, the invited allies that sort of, you know, just sort of, you know, participate in the fandom sort of as a little bit outsider, but we kind of get it on the inside. We got one toe in, if you will. And I know that it's the privilege of my life to be able to do that. But, you know, I think that's the important thing is that, you know, when we need to pull out the credentials, because those are the things that are going to sway people, which shouldn't be the case, but it is the case anyway. We have the PhDs, we've got the nearly 50 publications in, you know, we've got the hundreds of thousands of dollars of funding. And those are the things that unfortunately impress the rest of the world. So we get you, but we also know what the other world needs to make it
credible. I got a funny story too. So my middle kid got her bachelor's degree at Duke, and we get their catalog. So, I don't know if you know, they have a big primate lab. So one of the things in the Duke University catalog was lemur ears and tail. I love lemurs, I think they're awesome. If I could be King Julian, I'd be there. So, for a gift one year, I got my lemur ears and tail. And then when I wear them, especially in non-furry setting, they're like, so where do you think these came from? Just guess. Store, but I'm like, Duke University, hello.
Question for Dr. Conner?
Okay. I haven't looked left either.
What was your reaction to the infamous CSI furry scene?
I was just emerging as, whether I like to admit it or not, something of a prominent figure in the fandom at the time, and people asked me that question. I got a lot of queries, and my response initially was, for one thing, that was a stupid episode. It had one of the dumbest plots, big holes in it, scientifically indefensible. It was laughable. People ask me, is that what furries are about? And my reply to them was, do you usually shape your opinion of the world by what you see on primetime television? When it came out, I knew what was going to happen. I was in my office at work, and it was the following day. And I could hear my coworkers gathering in the hallway. And I could hear whispering, you ask, no, you ask, no, no, you ask, no, you, no, all right, you ask, okay. And there was a timid knock, and without turning around, I said, yes, what is it? And behind me, I heard a voice say, Sam, we were watching CSI last night. And I said, yes. And they said, is that what happens at your convention? And I turned around wearily and I said, if that was happening at my convention, number one, why don't I know about it? Number two, why am I not invited? That's called deflection. But the CSI episode, the Sex 2K episode, many of you are young and don't remember these things. The article that George Gurley printed in Vanity Fair in 1999. They were scathing, they were damning indictments of furry fandom. They were not at all true. If there was a grain of truth to them, it was so buried under the sensationalism you couldn't find it anymore. But all of these things came out. And after they came out and the dust settled, we were still here. That's my response. You know, did they injure us? Nah. So let them have their fantasies. We know what we are. We know what we're here for. And in the intervening years, the whole concept of furries as some kind of sexual deviance has fallen by the wayside as more and more people have looked at the data, have seen the sort of things furries do. It's a little bit difficult. If you're out there to write an article about, oh, furries are a bunch of sexual deviants, and then you get a news report that there was a furry convention at a hotel that was playing host to a large crowd of refugees from a war-torn country in the Middle East. And when these terrified families with crying children arrived, all the furries gathered around them and comforted them. Think we're sexual deviants? Okay, yeah. Fuck you, okay? Narrow that down a little, okay?
Is actually the current one we have going on right now. It's on fantasy engagement and fandoms. And in fact, what you are seeing is 1/12 of what that project is going to be. So we are looking at fandoms in furries, anime fans, fantasy sport fans, and actually just sport fans. It's actually going to be bigger than that. Kathy will be happy about that. And then we're looking at it in America, in North America, England, Germany, and then Japan. Yeah, we're working on the sports versus fantasy sports. We need to test that in America first. But the answer is that we are really interested in using multiple fandoms to answer these questions, particularly for me, for fantasy engagement and identity resolution. So in our previous work that we had that was government-funded, thank you, Government of Canada, for funding our work, what we noticed was that the self-created identity of the furry fandom was functional for identity resolution more than anime fandom, which is usually occupying other creative identities, such as the, you know, cosplay. And then it was our control group is always sport fans. And we were, you know, both of those are more functional than the sport fan control group. Why do we use sport fan control group? Because sport fans, if we look at sport fans, they're pretty mutually exclusive.
The fandom and the two fandoms don't usually merge. Like when we ask furries, one of the things that you hate, sports is actually the thing that pops up. So it turns out that for research, that becomes a really awesome control group for studying the things that we're interested in.
We had, I think, Devin, who's been helping with Edinburgh, almost fell out of his chair because he had seen one person identify as a furry and a sports fan out of like the thousand surveys we got back.
So yeah, we'll have to deal with that data then as it is, right, with the sport fan. But yeah, we're very interested. So I'm an identity researcher. That's my training. I'm a neo-Ericksonian person who likes looking at the transition to adulthood and how people become adults and how they begin to know themselves. And for me, the functionality of the fursona is particularly interesting because it seems to allow for an exploration in a safe environment that has structure that seems to be missing from the rest of our, you know, Western, postmodern world. Most people are left to flounder on their own, and this particular community seems to not only support but demonstrate how to figure out who you are through the development of persona. And so that, for me particularly, is the most interesting in relation to other fandom. In relation to other fandom comparisons. And the Awu thing, I'll mention.
It's not just who you are, though. It's like, typically, I think, an idealized self.
Well, yeah, that's
something
certainly
that the person kind of wants to aspire to.
Yeah, and I mean, like, identity researcher, the thing that's most interesting to me is the in-depth exploration of what that idealized version of self is. Like, what does each freckle represent on a persona? What does each element of the characteristic, whether it's because it's it's an animal and it's associated with particular types of attributes that are, you know, pleasing aesthetically or personally or, you know, emotionally, those are the kinds of things that people are working through these identity questions. And what I know as a person outside of the furry fandom who studies identity is that the more people know themselves, typically the better off we see